From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. You don't have to be a Christian to appreciate Christmas time.
There is a lot about the season that's universal. It's about light. It's about us and providing light for the world.
Rabbi Brian Glusman is with the Marcus Jewish Community Center of Atlanta. Today, we'll consider Christmas traditions through the eyes of non-Christians. First, though, earlier this week, we talked about the worst holiday songs of all time.
Here comes Santa Claus, here comes Santa Claus, right down Santa Claus Lane. Vixen and Blitzen and all his reindeer pulling on the rain.
Here are your first thoughts. Janet Hill writes to us, "This reminded me of a family story. When my grandfather was asked what songs he wanted played at his funeral, he responded, anything but that darn little drummer boy. My favorite Christmas album is the Jackson 5 Christmas album from 1970, and Elvis Presley's Blue Christmas has to be one of the best Christmas songs." So you can give us either the worst Christmas and holiday music that you know or the best. Take your choice. Call us at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter and Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. For the first time, Atlanta has a police officer dedicated to handling cases of animal cruelty. That position was created in October by the city's police chief, Erica Shields, and the first cop to fill that post is Amy Seldner. She's a 22-year veteran of the force and joins me in the studio now. Hi.
Hi, Celeste.
So after 22 years dealing with regular police work, why did you want this job?
Well, I actually started doing animal cruelty crimes very early on in my career, and I would have officers contacting me once they found out that I was pursuing those particular types of crimes.
You were pursuing those by choice? Like, that's what you wanted to do?
Well, I've been a beat cop for many years, and so I was handling 911 calls, you know, the domestics, the stolen cars, the burglaries, all the usual 911 calls, but I was also... I guess I was in tune to the different animal cruelty issues in the different communities that I worked in. And so when something would come along, you know, I'd pursue it. I'd get the warrants. I'd identify the perpetrator if we could, get the animal out of the situation. And over time, I guess that people just kind of identified me with those particular crimes.
You became the animal cop.
Yes.
So is it particularly, is it relatively easy in Georgia and in Atlanta to get those warrants to pursue these cases?
It can be if you have an eyewitness that's willing to come forward, or you have forensic veterinary, you know, forensics behind the case.
That's tough, though.
Right. Because you have an actual victim that can't speak. So you have to speak for them.
Let me play you this comment from Cliff Flynn. He's a sociologist. He studies why people abuse animals. And I spoke with him a couple years ago about this just long amount of research that shows this link between animal cruelty and violent crime against people.
There's no doubt that those two things occur together. Which cases do we need to focus on that may lead to violence against people? These would be, for example, where the person used more torture as opposed to just harming the animal, violence that took place alone versus in the presence of others.
Is it useful for law enforcement to begin to sort of plumb this relationship between people who would harm animals might also be people who would harm other people?
Absolutely. There is a correlation without a doubt. Since I've had this position, I've handled a domestic violence situation. So where the perpetrator had choked the animal in front of a 16-year-old child and then assaulted the woman, the owner of the dog. So right there, you've got a simple battery charge. You've got a cruelty to children because it happened in front of the child. And you also have a couple counts of animal cruelty. So those are not isolated events. Approximately 76% of all women that enter domestic violence shelters report abuse of their animals.
And it's interesting that you mention that. So let me play you another comment from Maya Gupta, who's executive director of the Animals and Society Institute. And she says there's this increasing awareness of what you're talking about, animal abuse and the ripple effect in these cases.
So, for example, in increased public attention recently to the lack of facilities for animals at domestic violence shelters and the fact that often victims of domestic violence are remaining in abusive situations because they can't bring their animals with them to safety.
So how does your new position help fix this, or does it?
No. What's wonderful about this is I can focus solely on those particular crimes. So I can follow it from the minute that that victim calls in to identifying the perpetrator, to getting the statements or witness testimony, if we need to do photo lineups, whatever they need, if they need victim witness advocacy to help them for a restraining order. This particular woman that I was speaking of, she ended up with a restraining order, and she had the animal included in it because he wanted the animal back, and we don't want that to happen while the case is going forward.
So you can get a restraining order that that person can't be within a certain distance of the animal as well.
Absolutely.
That's interesting. So what other kind, what is the, this sounds awful, but what is the most common type of animal cruelty in Atlanta? What is the case that's common for you?
Well, there's two types that you'll come across. As your individual, the male speaker said, you've got intentional and you've got neglect. So we see a tremendous amount of neglect where, you know, the animal's chained up outside, may or may not be starving, may or may not have fresh food or water, may or may not have shelter. Those kind of things are very, very common. The intentional ones are the ones where we're also going after, obviously, which are your shootings, your blunt force trauma, any kind of poisonings. We have, unfortunately, a problem with juveniles, and that's a precursor to future violence. So if we can stop them when they're younger or get them counseling or get them help, they may be less likely to go on and perpetrate crimes against humans in the future.
Do you have the resources at your disposal to be able to do that?
Yes. Been phenomenal community in Atlanta. You've got rescue groups out there. You've got Fulton County Animal Services. You've got Carla Smith, the councilwoman, who spoke with Chief Shields and Chief Shields getting this together. We've got the courts. We've got the city courts. We've got the state courts. We've got a tremendous amount of support out there. We've got grassroots communities. There's an organization called the Wonder Dogs that's out there keeping kids out of the gangs and having them work by delivering hay and build dog houses and working with the kids.
Actually, let's hear from Grace Hamlin, the founder of Wonder Dogs. This organization's mission is to lift up disadvantaged kids in Atlanta by having them help with rescue animals.
But my ultimate goal is to help the kids find their voice by helping animals. So if you become the voice for the animal right now and advocate for the animal and advocate for the community, the ultimate goal is for them to eventually learn how to advocate for themselves, their community, and their future.
How well do people know about you and whether or not they can call the PD when there's animal issues? Because you'd assume that they either call the shelter or animal control, right?
Yes. Well, this position has only been going on for 2 months, but I've been attending the roll calls with the officers in the different zones and handing out flyers, brochures, telling them exactly, you know, what the unit is about so that they can feel free to reach out. In January, I'll start going to the NPU meetings in different communities.
NPU means?
The Neighborhood Planning Units, organizations, NPO, did I say that right?
Yeah,
so we'll be, as well as now, we have a system in place just recently this past week where when a animal cruelty comes in, that call will be directed towards me so that it's going to be going into the system to me, so I'll be able to handle it. We'll know that when it comes in, it's just not going to kind of be dispersed amongst, you know, investigators out there. They'll know that that's specifically going to be handled.
And how does that help? In other words, is the benefit in having it all in one particular clearinghouse so you get a record and a picture of what all these cases are? How does it help to have it all coming to you?
Well, a lot of times the investigators, it's not their fault. They just have never been trained. And I have attended a lot of training as far as illegal dogfighting, the domestic violence aspect of it with the animals. And so I'm able to... I know what I need to look for as far as evidence. I know, whereas the investigators, you know, they've been trained in a lot of different things that I wouldn't necessarily know how to do. So, and they were reaching out anyway, and I said, well, if I can help you with this, I will. So it benefits the city because now you have a caller where before it might be rerouted to animal control. And as I've said before, bless their hearts, they're doing a great job, but they're underfunded. They just anybody been to the shelter recently? You know what I mean?
They need help.
And so they're doing all of Fulton County. So now you've got somebody in the city that's able to hone in on some of these crimes. And I work with them also. Like they'll let me know if they got something that is a little bit above that, you know, that they need assistance with.
How important is it for you to end up creating files on, I guess, repeat offenders or areas in which animals are an issue of either neglect or dogfighting? Does that, from a law enforcement perspective, just having that history become an asset?
Without a doubt. I keep files on every one of my cases. I've actually got two Rubbermaid totes at my own house from all the cases
that's
I've handled over the years.
That's 2 months, or that's all the years?
Yeah, that's in the last 2 months, though, I probably have about, there's probably about 12 to 13 cases going right now.
So, in 2 months?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
So, and that's just, that's with getting it out there. So it provides a continuous flow that somebody knows who to reach out to, and they know that they're going to be heard, at least, that it's not going to get lost in an inbox somewhere, that it's not going to get lost, you know, on a voicemail if they're trying to call something in. So I can actually go right to the victim, and I can get down, and we can get into the meat of it.
Do you see your job as primarily protecting animals or protecting people from animals?
I see it as a two-way street, because when you benefit people, you benefit animals. When you benefit the animals, you're benefiting the people. You're keeping people safe. So we obviously had a situation last January where two children in Southwest Atlanta were mauled and one was killed. We have a problem. We've obviously got a problem. If we've got animals running around loose and irresponsible owners, we can go after that. That these are areas that we can improve the lives of the elderly. We can improve the lives of children. We can improve the lives of the animals and the people involved, you know, victims of domestic violence. So I think that public safety is a huge issue. People want to feel safe. You know, they want to feel safe going to that bus stop. They want to feel safe. You know, in some parts of the city, that you'll see women who are power walking and they're walking with large sticks. That's not to protect themselves. That's to protect themselves from loose animals. So these are all, it's a multi-pronged approach to the topic of animal cruelty.
Do you have pets?
I do.
What kind of pets do you have?
I have four mixed breeds.
Four mixed breeds? Are they all rescue animals?
Yes.
And they're all different ages?
Yes. I'm trying to think what
they're
range
all dogs,
from.
I
yeah.
assume.
They range from about five to, I've got one that's going on 12.
Wow, that's kind of old.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good range of them. And so you're a dog person.
Yeah.
But you're there to protect the cats and the turtles.
Oh, yeah. I had a 15-year-old cat that just passed away in May.
Sorry.
So I did have one, and you know he's a trooper. He's living with all those dogs. So,
yeah, that's got to be a cat with a strong personality.
Yeah.
Amy Seldner is the senior patrol officer with Atlanta PD and the force's only officer dedicated solely to animal cruelty crimes. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Coming up, we'll take a look at some of what Christmas is about if you are not a Christian, if you're an atheist or a Jew or a Muslim or some other faith or non-faith. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. 100 years ago, the world was at war. World War I, the Great War, the war to end wars. It began in July of 1914 and lasted 4 years. But in December of 1914, something remarkable happened. For a week before Christmas Day, at various places along the battle lines, French, British, and German soldiers laid down their arms. They left their trenches for the no man's land that separated them. They talked, sang carols, and wished each other Merry Christmas. That's known as the Christmas Truce, and it didn't ever happen again. I talked about the Christmas Truce with Emory University professor Patrick Allitt. First, tell me about that event, and what about it actually makes us remember it 100 years later?
I think it's partly the fact that the war was so violent and so much more difficult for either side to win than they'd expected. When the war began, the idea was that it was all going to be over incredibly quickly. Warfare had become so highly industrialized in the preceding 100 years that all the great nations were afraid that whoever mobilized first would win very quickly. That obviously proved to be a massive miscalculation because defensive weapons were so much more powerful than offensive ones. So then both sides got stuck in the trenches. And the casualty rates also horrified everybody, that literally every day hundreds of people, sometimes thousands, were being killed. So already by Christmas of 1914, when the war had been going on for 4 months, there was a terrible feeling of exhaustion and disillusionment. And the soldiers more or less spontaneously said, we're going to take a day off from this. They certainly weren't authorized to do it.
Well, one of those soldiers was Captain Charles Stockwell, one of the first soldiers to take part in the truce. And we have, actually, this is a dramatic reading of one of his letters about this day. This comes from the History Channel.
I ran out into the trench and found that the Saxons were shouting, "Don't shoot. We don't want to fight today. We will send you some beer." A German officer appeared and walked out into the middle of no man's land. So I moved out to meet him amidst the cheers of both sides. We met and formally saluted. He introduced himself as Count something or other and seemed a very decent fellow.
Very decent. That's British, isn't it? But first of all, let's talk about what no man's land is. What is that?
Because the weapons were so dangerous, the men very rapidly realized they had to dig trenches into the ground simply to stay out of sight of one another, to stay alive. And so all the way across northern Europe, from the North Sea coast to the Swiss border, lines of trenches developed. And very often the English soldiers would only be a couple of hundred yards from the German soldiers, each group in their own trenches, and each with the knowledge that if they appeared above the parapet of the trench, they'd be shot. And throughout the war, that's what happened. But they were close enough that they could hear each other's conversations. And as we just heard in that extract, very often the Christmas truce began with the singing of carols, and each side could hear the other. The German high command had also had the idea of sending Christmas trees to their men. Christmas trees were originally a German tradition. And sometimes the Germans would decorate the trees and put them up on the parapet so the English soldiers could see them. And when the singing started, and then especially when people on both sides started holding up white flags or holding up signs that said, "Don't shoot and we won't shoot," the slightly braver ones took the risk of climbing up and exposing themselves, which normally would be lethal, to begin to fraternize. I think also at first some of the truces were a very practical matter, that when men were shot during raids and attacks, sometimes their bodies would continue to lie there. And one of the things that happened during the truce was simply coming out to both sides agreeing to bury the bodies of the men from their own sides. But then it also led to fraternization, like the exchanging of tobacco, the exchanging of alcohol, like this officer mentioned, and then also to playing soccer matches.
I want to play you one more clip. This is Peter Simpkins of the Imperial War Museum talking about why we still remember this moment.
The Christmas truce was the last twitch of the 19th century. By that, I mean it was the last public moment in which it was assumed that people were nice. It was the last gesture that human beings are getting better the longer the human race goes on.
I wonder what you think of that assessment.
I think it's a very shrewd point, actually. The last time there'd been a great European war had been 1815, the Battle of Waterloo and the defeat of Napoleon, which had been 99 years previously. So although there had certainly been short conflicts in Europe, it was the idea was spreading that now the world was much more closely integrated than ever before. Industry was making it much wealthier than ever before. We'd got ways of resolving international conflicts peacefully. And so there was a feeling of dismay and surprise that a war of this magnitude should break out. But there was also a very strong traditions of civility. And certainly the officers in all the armies, British, French, German, and Austro-Hungarian and so on, all had the idea that as gentlemen, they had a lot in common. Similarly, a mood began to develop among the enlisted men that there was a common interest between the men on both sides as opposed to the senior officers behind the lines. One of the things that comes up constantly in the literature of the First World War is the idea of lions led by donkeys, that the brave men are in the front lines and they're the ordinary enlisted men, and their uncaring senior officers have sent them to die while living comfortably in French chateaus behind the lines.
So why was there no Christmas truce of 1915?
Because when the senior officers heard about what had happened in 1914, they were absolutely furious about it. Their view was, I mean, on the British side, for example, there was, we're fighting a war for freedom. Why on earth would you interrupt the quest for freedom to fraternize with the very people whose job it's your job to kill? They're the enemies of civilization. They're not people we should fraternize with. And so some of the people who'd participated in the truce were punished. Some were circulated out to different parts of the Western Front. And when Christmas 1915 came along and the war was still going on, very strict orders went out that nobody was to expose themselves to the enemy, and that if they saw any sign of concessions from the enemy, they were to shoot them down instantly. And so from then on, there was no subsequent Christmas truce.
That's Emory University professor Patrick Allett. He talked to me about the Christmas truce, when English, French, and German soldiers briefly stopped fighting during World War I. Millions of American Christians are preparing to celebrate Christmas and all of its attendant pleasures. Trees, exchanging presents, caroling maybe. But what about those who don't celebrate? It's a federal holiday and most businesses are closed. So what is Christmas like for the non-Christian? For that, I talked with three guests. Noah Legends co-hosts the Scathing Atheist podcast. Hi, Noah.
Hey, Celeste. How are you?
Good. Rabbi Brian Glassman is the Jewish Outreach Coordinator of the Marcus Jewish Community Center of Atlanta. You need a shorter title there, Brian.
I think I do.
And Dr. Abbas Farzegar teaches religious studies at Georgia State University. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Rabbi, talk to me about what this means for families when this is such a almost universal thing in the United States. How is this especially for families who stay home? How do you deal with that?
I agree. I think that there is a lot about the season that's universal. It's about light. It's about us and providing light for the world. Everywhere I go, I see lights. I see twinkling lights. I see houses decorated in lights. I see lights on Christmas trees. So I believe that there's a common theme, and the theme is light. And the question should be for every one of us, what are we doing to bring light into this world? The world is damaged. The world is fractured. The world is in need of repair. So it's about sharing our light.
And Abbas, this, of course, it's one thing for if you're of Jewish faith, because oftentimes Hanukkah falls right around the same time as Christmas. But Ramadan ended quite some time ago. So for kids especially, this is not a time when they're celebrating a holiday.
No, it's definitely not part of the natural Islamic ritual calendar. But because we are in the United States and because nobody can really avoid it, you know, one is engulfed in the culture that they're in. So Muslim families typically take moments like Thanksgiving or Christmas to simply do what others do, and that is to convene and to get together and spend time with one another. And there may be reflection about who the Prophet Jesus was in the Quranic context and in Islamic theology. In the United States, you have kind of a particular situation. However, in the Middle East and in greater Muslim countries, Muslim-majority countries, you have a very strong Christian presence in just about every country, and it's part of Muslim identity to honor and respect the Prophet Jesus, and so it becomes a national holiday, it becomes a national conversation, and many times in places like Palestine, in Turkey, even in Iran, you will find national conversations on radio, on television, amongst families to visit one another, to celebrate, to honor even the Christians amongst them who are celebrating the birth of Jesus. I mean, it's something that a lot of people wouldn't recognize with their image of Islam or Muslim countries from this side of the world. But when you are in the Middle East, this sort of exchange and mutual respect is just part and parcel of the holiday season of Christmas.
Noah, he talked about convening for a meal, and I know that we have a couple atheists in our family, and sadly, the holiday time is an opportunity for others to try to convert them. I wonder how often this happens to you.
Well, you know, as an atheist in South Georgia, you tend to get used to that happening constantly, regardless of what day it is. But I think it tends to be quite the opposite in my experience, that Christmas, Thanksgiving, those family gatherings tend to be the times when people are the least likely to try to bring up those ugly subjects, or I shouldn't say ugly subjects, but those subjects that, you know,
That make you uncomfortable.
Yeah, exactly.
Why do you think that is?
Because, again, I think that people get caught up, especially around Christmas, in the idea of embracing their fellow man. And I'm sorry for the inherent sexism in that statement, but I believe that people around Christmas, hopefully they buy into the themes of the holiday itself and remember that it is a holiday about universal brotherhood. And I think that that's something that we can all, sort of embrace together. And I don't think that that's, I think that that's something that pervades the holiday enough that when people are in the midst of the celebration, they're not generally thinking, I don't want this to sound negative, but they're not generally thinking of the religious aspects just so much as the universal aspects.
Yeah, if I could jump in there on a personal note, I was raised in a mixed faith family. My mother is from northern New Mexico, comes from a Catholic and Pentecostal background, and we grew up celebrating Christmas. And my older brother is a very proud evangelical now. And so all throughout our childhood, he would lead sort of grace at the table for Christmas, for the Christmas dinner. And when I started practicing Islam in my late teens, we sort of created a neutral ground where you would just leave the name Jesus out of the grace, and that was sort of, fair game. But it never got in the way of us convening the table and really celebrating Christmas together. And still now I can't help but get fuzzy during the holiday season and the Christmas trees and the lights and things like that.
Rabbi, how does the conversations go about the commercialization of Christmas? I mean, we're talking a lot about the deeper themes, but, mm-hmm. Christmas is also about Black Friday. Christmas
That's right.
is also about, expenditures on PS4s and Xboxes.
And I have to say that I appreciate the Christmas popularity, and I appreciate the commercialism because it's caused us as Jewish people to find more relevance in Hanukkah. The fact is that Hanukkah, for the Jewish community, is a relatively minor holiday. And were it not for location in the calendar,
if it weren't so close to Christmas,
that's correct, then Hanukkah would probably be obscure. So I appreciate the commercialism because it's caused us to reevaluate and rethink the holiday. We're also able to use the opportunity to do good, instead of eight nights of me, toys, Xbox, we can also take a night perhaps and give to others and do for others and create a charitable environment.
Many synagogues do a mitzvah day on Christmas. Explain what a mitzvah is.
Excellent. A mitzvah is an obligation or a commandment. It's mistranslated sometimes as a good deed. It's not a good deed. It's an obligation or a commandment. We're obligated to perform acts of support in this world, acts of goodness. One of the acts that we can perform really is helping our Christian brothers and sisters on Christmas, allowing them to have a day off. So Mitzvah Day provides an opportunity for us as Jews to work in the hospitals, to work in the nursing homes, and to provide opportunities for Christians to be with their families.
So walk me through a day, Noah, of Christmas. What do you generally do on that day?
Well, generally speaking, I would think my Christmas morning would be a lot like yours. I'll be with my family. I'll be with my wife's family, very Christian family. So I'll be smiling and nodding along and bristling through all the Jesus bits and taking it with a smile.
Do you sing carols even if they mention Jesus?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Like I said, I grew up on that music and I never lost my love for it. I also grew up in the 80s, so I sing a lot of satanic songs without a lot of thought to the lyrics in those either.
Are you talking about like Black Sabbath or something?
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
I don't think
they have any satanic Christmas carols, I'm not sure.
Only if you sing them in reverse.
Paul is dead. Paul is dead. What about you, Abbas? Walk me through a Christmas day for you.
Well, this Christmas, my wife will be doing, she won't call it a mitzvah day, but she'll be doing something similar where she'll be working at CNN during the daytime. And that morning, I'll be spending time in a retreat, actually, with a Muslim community organization to kind of get our end of the year and upcoming year planning done. And then in the afternoon, we'll all convene with our, with our family and whatnot. But we basically take it as a day off.
And this is one thing that gets overlooked all the time. While all the Christians are taking Christmas Day off, it's all the other people of other faiths and no faiths that are filling in and working on those days.
Yep.
But what about the stereotype that you're going to find all the Jewish families in a
Chinese restaurant? Yeah. And the reason for that stereotype, it's actually not a stereotype. It is true. All the Jews are gathered in Chinese restaurants. It's a religious, it's a mitzvah, a religious obligation.
It's an obligation.
Just kidding. Because Chinese restaurants are traditionally open on Christmas. A lot of Jews do go to Chinese restaurants. They see a movie first and then go out for Chinese dinner. But it is the one day on which the entire, during which the entire culture is closed. It's off. And it's so wonderful and peaceful as we begin Christmas Eve, as the traffic stops, life stops, and wake up the morning of Christmas. It is really the most relaxing, wonderful morning. I truly appreciate Christmas. Every office is closed, every business, every grocery store.
I have to say, we went to Disney World a few years ago on Christmas Day, and you would have thought that it was Muslim and Hindu Day at Disney World, because everybody at that park was from another faith or another part of the world. It was hilarious.
That's Abbas Barziger. He teaches religious studies at Georgia State University. We also heard from Rabbi Brian Glessman of the Marcus Jewish Community Center of Atlanta and Noah Legends of the Scathing Atheist podcast. Just ahead, Christmas would not be complete without the Peanuts Gang. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's On Second Thought. Tomorrow, we'll spend an hour looking back at our favorite conversations about Southern food. And we would love to hear about your favorite dishes during the holiday season. Maybe it's turkey. Maybe it's mashed potatoes. Maybe it's red beans and rice. What dish really makes the holidays for you? Call and let us know at 404-500-9457. And be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. One holiday tradition has stood the test of time for more than 50 years.
I guess you were right, Linus. I shouldn't have picked this little tree. Everything I do turns into a disaster. I guess I really don't know what Christmas is all about. Isn't there anyone who knows what Christmas is all about?
Sure, Charlie Brown. I can tell you what Christmas is all about.
A Charlie Brown Christmas is a beloved seasonal staple, but the Peanuts Gang's TV special would not have happened if it hadn't been for the Coca-Cola Company. Lee Mendelson was the executive producer of that special. He told me after it first aired in 1965, he didn't expect it to be on TV ever again.
When we had finished the show, Bill Melendez and I thought we had ruined Charlie Brown, and then we took it to the network. They thought it was too slow, so we all thought it would go on one time, and that would be it. But fortunately, half the country tuned in. Back then, there were only three networks, and almost, I think we had a 45 share of the country tune in. So fortunately, they liked it more than we did. And of course, it's surreal to us that it's still going after 50 years.
Do you still watch it?
Oh, our family gets together, sure. I have to see if there's any corrections we have to make.
Oh, have you had to make corrections over
there?
No,
I'm just kidding.
I was just about to say, I definitely want to hear about those.
Yeah, right.
Because I understand there's a couple things that were up for discussion. I mean, we'll get to the Coca-Cola moment in a second. But I also understand that once you finally started really getting into this, there was arguments. Charles Schulz reportedly didn't like the jazz music that Vince Guaraldi wrote.
Yeah, no, that's all part of the myth that's grown up over 50 years. We did a documentary on Mr. Schulz in 1963. And at the time, we hired Vince Guaraldi to do the music. And in fact, he wrote the Linus and Lucy theme for that show. And once Mr. Schulz heard that music, he loved it. And he loved Vince Guaraldi. And then 2 years later, when we did the Christmas show, we brought him again, and he did the next 15 specials. So there's been a myth that he didn't like the music, but he wasn't a fan of jazz until Vince Guaraldi, then he became a fan.
Well, I don't blame him. Since you're talking about Charles Schulz, let's actually hear his voice. This is from a 1987 interview that Schulz did with Good Morning America.
This is the foundation of it all. He cannot kick the football. He cannot win a ball game. It goes back, I think, to the old Little Abner and Daisy May premise there. He never should have gotten married. You know, it was a mistake. Readers would like to see Charlie Brown kick the football or to win a ball game, but it would be a terrible mistake because it would destroy what is really the basis of the whole strip.
What were the discussions like in writing the Christmas special with Charles Schulz?
Well, what happened is We did the documentary, and it was never broadcast.
Charles Schulz's day begins at 8:20 each morning when he drives four of his five children to school. Meredith, 14, Monty, 12, Craig, 11, and Amy, 8. On the way, picking up neighbors as well, we ask him how often his ideas come from his own children.
I think I probably get more ideas from watching my own kids than I probably really would like to admit.
McCann Erickson and Coca-Cola had seen the documentary, and 2 years later, Time magazine ran a cover story of the Charlie Brown characters, and McCann Erickson, a fellow named John Allen, called us on behalf of Coca-Cola, and he said, Coca-Cola is wondering if your same creative group had ever considered doing a Christmas special. This was in June of 65. And I said, absolutely.
Had you?
No. And I hung up. And, they said, well, we need an outline in 2 days down in Atlanta, which took me by surprise, 2 days. So anyway, I called Mr. Schulz, and I said, I think I just sold a Charlie Brown Christmas, I may have sold a Charlie Brown Christmas show. And he said, what in the world is that? And I said, it's something you're going to write tomorrow. And there was a long pause. He said, oh, okay, have Melendez come up from L.A., we can do it. So we met the next day, and we sat down and had to figure out in a few hours what our wonderful Christmas show was going to be.
And Melendez is the director, Bill
right.
Melendez.
The animator, yeah.
Yeah. So did you then have to make revisions to the story? How many revisions did it take?
Well, no, the original outline that we sent to Coca-Cola by Western Union, I might add, back then. The original outline that we put together in those 2 hours became the show.
Really?
6 months later. We made some really key decisions. We decided to use kid voices again. Up to then, only adults had done kids' voices. We decided to use the jazz music, traditional music, Beethoven music, Vince Guaraldi. We decided that I had read that previous Christmas, Hans Christian Andersen's Little Fir Tree, and I said maybe we could do something with a little tree. And then Mr. Schulz said he thought the whole thing should be based on the comic strips he had done each Christmas about the putting pressure on little kids doing Christmas plays. And then when it was just about over, the discussion, he said, I really think we ought to have Linus read from the Bible. If we're going to do a show about Christmas, we ought to talk about the true meaning of Christmas. And, of course, Bill Melendez and I looked at each other like, you know, holy smokes, how can you animate from the Bible?
And there were in the same country shepherds, abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them. And they were sore afraid. And the angel said unto them, Fear not. For behold, I bring you tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people.
I wonder if you ever got a clue as to why Coca-Cola, what it was about the documentary that the executives at Coca-Cola liked.
Well, we showed Charles Schulz drawing and talking about his characters. We had the Vince Guaraldi music, which was Linus and Lucy, which has become so famous since then. We animated 2 minutes. So all the elements were there for to come together. And then again, as I mentioned, with Time magazine doing a cover story, it just kind of everything coalesced at the same time. And this fellow at McCann Erickson, John Allen, was a big, big fan of Charlie Brown, and he was really the hero of the piece, and he's the one who got Coca-Cola interested in it.
Did Charles Schulz drink Coca-Cola?
As I recall, he did 50 years ago. I can't remember. I know that they at the end of the show, they put a Coke bottle on his desk, and he did thank Coca-Cola for doing a show for us, which is, I think, the only commercial he ever did. And it wasn't really a commercial. It was a thank you.
Let's take another listen to a little bit from the Christmas special itself. This is actually, you spoke about this a moment ago, about Charlie Brown's choosing that poor little tree.
Right.
And everyone, and he brings it back, and everyone gives him a tough time.
Boy, are you stupid, Charlie Brown.
What kind of a tree is that?
You are supposed to get a good tree. Can't you even tell a good tree from a poor tree?
I told you we'd goof it up. He's not the kind you can depend on to do anything right.
You're hopeless, Charlie Brown. Completely hopeless.
Rats!
What was it like to work with Coca-Cola? Because the stereotype is, of course, that big business comes in and tries to put a commercial stamp on everything and ruins great art.
The network left us completely alone. We had one interesting encounter from McCann Erickson. About halfway through, they sent someone in to look at our progress from the McCann office in L.A. And it was all in black and white. It was in pencil tests. It was very slow. We didn't have any music. And this fella came in. He looked at it. He says, you know, this is, I got to be honest with you, this is not very good. If I go back and tell everybody what I see here, you know, they may not want to do the show. And I said, well, please, this is, you know, you're looking at it with like one-third of the show there. Please, just put your trust in Charles Schulz and the Charlie Brown characters, and I think you'll be very pleased. Just, you know, trust us. So he gave me a long look in the eye. He says, all right, it may cost me my job, but I'm not going to say anything. So we came very close to disaster, but it didn't happen, and then we were able to finish. We never had any interference or anything from either the network or from Coca-Cola.
So then tell me about how, when you look back and every once in a while catch this special, what do you see? What do you see that maybe you would maybe want to change, or would you all leave it all exactly the same?
No, we never thought about changing anything because it seemed to work so well. At the time, we thought it was a little slow, as I said. In fact, the show was done, and it opened with an instrumental with the kids skating, a beautiful melody that Vince had written. And I said, but, you know, maybe we could get somebody to write some words to that so the opening would have a little more pizzazz, because Vince Guaraldi had been working with the children's choir in Northern California. I couldn't find any lyricists, so I sat down at my kitchen table for some reason and wrote out a poem called Christmas Time.
You are kidding me.
And, of course, you know yeah. What's happened to that ever since. And then he got the choir to sing that and Hark the Herald Angels Sing. Nothing we ever really wanted to change. It just seemed to go along really well. And most people know the show by heart now after all these years. They can recite many of the lines.
I'm certainly one of them.
I think there must be something wrong with me, Linus. Christmas is coming, but I'm not happy. I don't feel the way I'm supposed to feel. I just don't understand Christmas, I guess.
I wanted to take one more listen to Charles Schulz's voice, and he's kind of talking about how he wanted to bring more girls into the Peanuts gang. And this is, again, from that 1987 interview on Good Morning America.
I always wanted to create a separate group of characters across town because I think the strip was becoming too boy-oriented, mm-hmm. Charlie Brown and Linus and the others. And eventually, Marcy met Peppermint Patty. Why she calls him Sir, I don't have the slightest idea, or calls her. But they become very good friends. I love the little relationship that they have. They tease each other and mock each other, but they're very loyal to each other.
He talks oftentimes, and that's not the only place in which he talks about the characters as though he sees them as living people.
Oh, they were very real to him, absolutely. And to us, too. I remember I once had the whole six kids in my car talking together. It was, you know, kind of blew my mind to have them all in the same spot. But no, he believed absolutely.
You had them real. You had the real kids who'd done the voices talking in
yeah,
your car.
Yeah. And he loved the characters. He loved doing. He did 18,000 strips. And by the way, while I'm talking to you in Atlanta, we did more things with Coca-Cola. 2 years later, they sponsored. We did John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie with Henry Fonda. And they sponsored the show, and we got an Emmy nomination for that. And then a few years after that, we had Willie Mays. My first documentary ever for the network was Willie Mays, and Coca-Cola sponsored a show, Tips on Baseball, from Willie Mays. So we had a wonderful relationship back in the day.
Well, the Charlie Brown special got both an Emmy and a Peabody Award.
Right.
And I wonder what you think about it out of all. I mean, there have been a lot of Christmas specials, and some of them have been outstanding. What about the Charlie Brown Christmas stands the test of time? It's been a half a century.
Well, there were two shows before us, the year before Rudolph and Frosty. And, of course, they were both based on the music and the songs. And our show had a lot of music, too. And I think it was the music behind all these shows that were key to their success. And also, it really goes all back to the Charles Schulz characters and his dealing with the failure and unrequited love and bulliness. It really goes back to Charlie Brown's daily struggles and our daily struggles, and I think that's why it's has stood the test of time. What Mr. Schulz was writing about 50 years ago is as real as it now as it was back then. And I think that's the test of time is in good writing. It still comes down to the story, and he knew how to do a great story.
So at what point did you realize that it was a classic? I mean, you said that it aired the first time. You thought it would never air again, so maybe it came back the next year. What point did you realize?
Well, when 45% of the country tuned in, that didn't mean it was a hit yet. We didn't know if they would tune in the next time.
Yeah.
Time Magazine ran a wonderful review of it and said it should be repeated every year. And we heard from people all over the country. And I don't think we ever dreamed. We at that time, we said, well, maybe we'll get one repeat because of all this activity. But we didn't assume it was going to go 50 years. Although, when we finished it, and Bill Lenz and I thought it was too slow at the screening, and one of the animators stood up and said, you two guys are crazy. This thing's going to run for 100 years. And we thought he was crazy. But so far, he's been half right.
My last question for you, and I realize it might be controversial, but I'm hoping you'll tell me which of the Peanuts gang characters is your favorite.
Oh, no, it's not controversial at all. I think Charlie Brown, because Mr. Schulz said once, he's the kind of kid you'd like to have as a next-door neighbor. And I think the fact that he represents all of our daily struggles, he keeps coming back and he keeps fighting back, and he's really a very nice little kid. And I think he's by far my favorite, although Snoopy certainly, in animation, was critical to our success as well.
That is Lee Mendelson. He was the executive producer of A Charlie Brown Christmas. It premiered 50 years ago. So firstly, congratulations.
Thank you.
And secondly, thanks so much.
My pleasure, and thanks to everybody in the Atlanta area. We always get good ratings. And thanks to Coca-Cola. It never would have happened without them.
Have a good one, and a happy holiday.
Thank you.
She wouldn't try to trick me on a traditional holiday. This time I'm going to kick that football clear to the moon.
Ah!
Isn't it peculiar, Charlie Brown, how some traditions just slowly fade away?
That's a scene from A Charlie Brown Christmas. You can watch that holiday classic tomorrow night at 8 o'clock on ABC. And that's it for today's show, but we want to hear from you. What is your favorite holiday movie? Maybe it's a non-traditional one like Die Hard. Maybe it's a traditional one like It's a Wonderful Life. Give us a call at 404-500-9457 or reach out on Twitter. It's at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.